We are still at that order of business, the bills on third reading and final passage. The next bill for our consideration is House Bill 204.
House Bill 204, introduced by Representative Gay, an act relating to public schools requiring a flag to be displayed in each classroom as specified, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
House Bill 204 having been read three separate times, the question is, shall the bill pass? The chief clerk will call the roll.
Barbudo. Berger, Blake, aye. Flickery, aye. Bonner, aye. Lawton, aye. Brechtel, aye. Brown, aye. Burkhart, aye. Bird, aye. Campbell, aye. Kennedy, aye. Childers, aye. Connolly, no. Kraft, aye. Davison, yeah. Edmonds, aye. Eklund, aye. Esquivel, aye. Freeman, Gay, Gingery, Goggles, Greer, Green, Harshman, Harvey, Hunt, Illaway, Yagi, Kasparic, Croker.
Aye.
Crone. Crone. Lockhart.
Aye.
Laux.
Aye.
Lubnow.
Aye.
Madden.
No.
McKim.
Aye.
McComey.
Aye.
Miller.
Aye.
Moniz.
Aye.
Nicholas.
Aye.
Patton.
Aye.
Peasley.
Aye.
Pedersen excused. Peterson.
Aye.
Petroff.
Aye.
Korberg.
Aye.
Roscoe.
Aye.
Simlick.
Aye.
Shepperson excused. Stewart.
Aye.
Stubson.
Aye.
Teeters.
Aye.
Throne.
Aye.
Braunisch.
Aye.
Wallace.
Aye.
Zwanitzer Dan.
No.
Zwanitzer Dave.
Aye.
Mr. Speaker.
Aye.
Harshman.
Excused.
Harshman excused. Crone.
Aye.
I'm about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Bird. Aye to no. Goggles. Aye to no. Kraft. The vote is closed. 52 ayes, 5 noes, 3 excused.
House Bill 204, having received the affirmative vote of the majority of the members elected to the House, House Bill 204 has passed the House. The next bill for consideration is House Bill 264.
House Bill 264, introduced by Representative Harshman, an act relating to education regarding the Hathaway Scholarships, school notifications, being enacted by the legislature of the state of Wyoming.
House Bill 264, having been read 3 separate times, the question is, shall the bill pass? The chief clerk will call the roll.
Barbudo. Berger, Blake, Blickrey, Bonner, Botten, Brechtel, Brown, Burkhart, Bird, Campbell, Kennedy, Childers, Connolly, Kraft, Davison, Edmonds, Eklund, Esquivel, Freeman, Gay, Gingery, Goggles.
Aye.
Greer.
Aye.
Green.
Aye.
Harshman excused. Harvey.
No.
Hunt.
Aye.
Illaway.
Aye.
Yagi.
Aye.
Kasparic.
Aye.
Croker.
No.
Crone.
Aye.
Lockhart.
Aye.
Laux.
Aye.
Lubnow.
Aye.
Madden.
No.
McKim.
No.
McComey.
Aye.
Miller.
No.
Moniz.
Aye.
Nicholas.
Aye.
Patton.
Peasley. No.
Pedersen excused. Peterson.
No.
Petroff.
Aye.
Korberg.
No.
Roscoe.
No.
Simlick.
No.
Shepperson excused. Stewart.
No.
Stubson.
No.
Teeters.
Aye.
Throne.
No.
Braunisch.
Aye.
Wallace.
No.
Zwanitzer Dan.
No.
Zwanitzer Dave.
No.
Mr. Speaker.
Aye.
I am about to close the vote. Are there any changes? Harshman. Excused to aye. Are there any other changes? Peasley. No to aye. Berger. Berger, would you confirm your vote? An aye. Thank you. Are there any other changes? The vote is closed. 35 ayes, 23 noes, 2 excused.
House Bill 264, having received the affirmative vote of the majority of those members elected to the House, House Bill 264 has passed the House. We're at that order of business. Consideration of bills on general file. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Speaker, I move the House resolve itself into committee of the whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The House has resolved itself into the committee of the whole. Representative Brown.
Committee of the Whole will come to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 2. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 2, introduced by Capital Financing, an act relating to administration of government, state treasurer reports. This bill was referred to Committee Number 2 Appropriations, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Edmonds, Esquivel, Harshman, Pedersen, Stewart, Wallace, sign representing Berger, chairman.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Bill number Senate File 2 do pass. Ladies and gentlemen, this deals with the State Treasurer's report, and what we've done, in essence, is just change the date from October 1 to November 1. What we found is that we did not have enough of the data in order to compile good reports, so we've just changed that date, and I'd ask for your favorable consideration.
Further discussion on the bill? Question being called. All in favor of Chairman Berger's motion that when the committee of the report, committee of the whole reports to do so with the recommendation that House bills or Senate File 2 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 11. Senate File 2 is passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 11. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 11, introduced by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to children in need of supervision. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Peasley, Throne. No, Brechtel, excused, Brown. Signed, representing Brechtel, Vice Chair.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown? Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 11 do pass, and I turn the explanation over to the representative from District 11. Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Folks, today I bring you a interim committee bill from your committee, number one. This is to streamline decision making in the placement of our children in need of supervision. It's a very simple change. It was brought to us for a number of reasons, but also something supported by our judiciary. All this allows is that when you're moving making a change for a child who's in custody from a more restrictive environment to a less restrictive environment on a temporary basis, this can be done without going to the court. But because the bill is so short, I think it's important for the body to know that there are protections in place. This is a temporary change, and it provides notice to all relevant parties who can then object if they choose and trigger a court hearing. What this does is allow an initial administrative change, again, from a restrictive environment to a less restrictive environment. But it does provide, although not mentioned in the bill, for all the protections that are still in statute if anybody has any objections. And with that, I would stand for questions.
Any further discussion? Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, and maybe with regard to the Child in Need of Supervision Act, it's different. But don't we already have and I guess maybe that's what you're speaking to, it's not in the bill and it's in current law. Can't we already give out written notice regarding a change in placement that's of a lesser restriction? And if people don't respond, then we don't have to go back to court. And if so, I guess I don't understand how this bill is different, unless it's just for the chins versus the delinquency and the neglect statutes.
Representative Throne.
Mr. Chairman, this is for chins. And the existing statute provides that when you have a temporary change of placement, unless there is something specific in the court order, before you can even do a temporary change in placement, you have to go back to the judge. So the purpose of this bill is to eliminate the requirement when there's a temporary change to go, that you don't have to go back to the judge but it remains in statute that at least 10 days prior to the permanent change in placement, there's still written notice of the proposed placement to the child, the parents, and then if none of the relevant parties object, it becomes permanent. So this is really to avoid an extra trip before the judge that is not really necessary, but the right to go before the judge is preserved in existing law.
Speaker Pro Tem Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to continue with the explanation that was just given, to answer the speaker's question, this is going down, not up. So it used to be either direction you were going. So if you were taking a kid and you wanted to go up in placement, meaning a more restrictive, you had to go back to the court. And if you wanted to go down and take a kid down in restriction, you had to go back to the court. All this is doing is saying, if you want to go down, you don't have to go back to the court. If you want to go up, you still go back to the court. So if you want to make it more restrictive, you have to ask the court. But what happens is, so you have a kid in one type of placement, the residential facility or wherever they're at writes a letter or says, you know, we've done everything we can for this kid. He actually doesn't need to be here. It's actually costing you a lot of money to have him here. He actually could go to a different type of facility that's less restrictive, and so you should do that. And they write this letter. The problem was, and then there's this time period, and the speaker's right. What happened used to, you'd send the letters out, you'd wait for everybody, and people didn't respond, and then you'd go ahead and do it. What this will do is just speed it up by a few days. DFS, who would have the jurisdiction, would be able, once they receive that letter, make that decision right away and take them from a higher level to a lower level without consulting the court.
Mr. Speaker.
Thank you, and thank you to both of the good representatives for the explanation. And we can continue this discussion perhaps for second reading. But the way the language you're stripping out is this on line one, page one, line 16 and 17, and then the word placement on the second page, line one, is absent a specific provision in the placement order requiring prior court approval. So if you have a court order for the initial placement and it does not require you to come back, you already have the ability to move the child to a similar or less restrictive confinement. And then there's some things in there like we already talked about. You have to give the 10 days notice, and if nobody objects, etc. But, and maybe we can think of some examples of this, but it says absent the specific provision. So when you're going into the initial placement, the court puts something in there that says, hey, I'd like to know if you guys plan on moving this child to a lesser restrictive placement, then I want to know about that. But if it's not in there, you can go ahead and do it under the current provision. So I don't understand why we're taking out this absent a specific provision in the placement. So the question then becomes, do we have a lot of courts placing this specific provision in every order? And if so, it's probably a county attorney doing it. But do we have a lot of courts that have a specific provision in the placement saying, hey, I want court approval, or I want you to come to me to get court approval before you do any change in placement? Now, that hasn't been my experience, but I'd like to know if that's the case in other jurisdictions. Otherwise, when you approve this bill and you strip out this language, you're basically leaving it totally in the hands of the Department of Family Services, and you're stripping the court the ability in that initial placement order to say, hey, I want you guys to come back to me before I'm going to approve a change in placement. So that's just for discussion purposes.
Minority Whip Throne, why don't you answer that specific? Or would you rather have me have...
I thought the good Speaker Pro Tem...
Okay, Speaker Pro Tem Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Speaker is totally correct on that, that how it's worded today, that DFS can do this on their own unless the court has something where they've put in a provision saying, I want to know if you're ever going to go down in or up in placement. The testimony we got during interim was a bunch of judges just put this in all their orders. It becomes in their forms, and so it just gets in there. And in many situations, the judge really didn't need to see this kid again. So what happens is DFS really needs to move the kid down in restriction. We're waiting on the judge, that, you know, got to wait for a hearing date. And this kid has sat in a facility for up to 30, 60 days that he really shouldn't have been in that facility. Number one, it was inappropriate for the child to be there. Number two, and this is what we've spent a lot of time, we had a meeting in Sheridan and spent a whole day on this, we're spending about $30 million on these placements every year. This was one way we felt that we could manage the costs a little better, that if it was going down in restriction, that DFS, I mean, no, it's very rare that you would ever see a judge say, no, I want him to stay there. Now, they might have a different argument if you're going up in restriction, but it was such a standard thing. The decision of the committee was, let's give that to DFS, take that away from the judge. So the speaker's correct. This is a power being taken away from the judge, but it's reducing the restriction, not raising it, and it could potentially save us some money, and it also assists the child in getting them to the more appropriate facility in a quicker manner.
Minority Whip Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and just to follow up on the good Speaker Pro Tem's remarks, while it does, again, allow the DF department to make temporary placements, it's all still done according to court order with notice to parties and opportunity to object. But again, it doesn't leave the child in limbo as the current situation does.
Any further discussion? Question hasn't been called. All those in favor of Representative Brown's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation in House Bill number, Senate File 11, do pass. Please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Senate File 11 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Representative Chairperson Berger.
Mr. Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor?
Please proceed.
For a short person, I sure have a lot of titles. Today, it's really my honor here to present some special guests in the West Gallery, and I thought maybe what we would do is hold our applaud until I'm done introducing them. For some of you that are new to the legislature, you may not be as familiar with our Wyoming WAMI program, which is preparing and returning physicians to Wyoming. And WAMI stands for Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho. So we offer this educational program. It's a cooperative with rural states. And it's the University of Washington School of Medicine is the regional medical education system that we partner with. And I have the honor of introducing 16 students that will be starting their second year at the University of Washington. Chairman Harvey and I had the privilege of meeting with them earlier today, and they are an incredibly bright group of young people. One of the other statistics I wanted to give you is because we do good work here, folks, and I am so proud of this program and these young people. Since 1997, we've had 163 Wyoming students participate in this program, with 96 of them graduating as of October 2010. 41 of those students have returned to Wyoming practicing medicine here. That's 67%. I think that's a terrific return on our investment. More importantly, to have some of the most stellar young people come back to our state and practice and live here. So what I'd like to do is have each of you stand up when I call your name, and I hope that I don't do too bad of a job on that. But we have Ryan Abazadeh from Gillette, Campbell County, Katie Brown Smoot from Lincoln County. Oh, look at this. They already know alphabetically who they are. Catherine Cantaway from Laramie, Albany County, Lindsay Capcron from Cody Park, Jacqueline Foss from Casper Natrona, Kyle Hancock from Evanston, Uinta, Dane Hill, Evanston, Uinta, Crystal Jones from Buffalo, Johnson County, Amy Kennedy from Wheatland, Platte County, Megan McKay from Casper, Natrona, David Mills, Tensleep, Washakie. Trenton Morton, Cody, Park. Emily Reed, Wilson, Teton County. Alyssa Springer, Sheridan County. Gita Sriharan from Rollins, Carbon County. Mallory Sullivan from Jackson, Teton County. And with them is Dr. Suzanne Allen, the Vice Dean for Regional Affairs, University of Washington School of Medicine. So give them a welcome, Wyoming. Yeah, please stand up. Thank you for your dedication. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman Berger. Welcome to the House, Wyoming students, really the pride of Wyoming. And members, we've, and if you'll recall, you'll have an opportunity to vote in our budget bill to increase this program from a cohort of 16 to 20. And I just want to remind you that as I take privilege of the floor. And again, these are some of the most important health care reform things we've done is really encourage our best and brightest to come back here and practice medicine in our rural state. So thank you and best wishes in Seattle, and we look forward to your return. Thank you, Chairman Berger. Chairman Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I had an addendum to my introduction. The other thing that was amazing is we were concerned in joint appropriations when we expanded it from 16 to 18 to 20, what would happen with the program? Would we have enough applicants? We had 57 applicants. We can take 20, and we have 13 alternates, and they are bright. And isn't that exciting to think that we have that reservoir of talent? So thank you all.
Okay. Thank you, members. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 15. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 15, introduced by the Joint Judiciary Committee, an act relating to court jurisdiction. This bill was referred to Committee No. 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Barbudo, Brechtel, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Peasley, Throne, excused, Nicholas, signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 15 do pass, and I turn the explanation of the bill over to the representative from District 11.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill was brought to the interim Committee Number 1 by our friends across the street who wear the long black robes. This is part of a combined effort of streamlining our courts and making them more efficient. Both the previous Chief Justice and the current Chief Justice have been advocates of working hard, not to streamline our courts for efficiency's sake, but to try to make them more effective so that everyone has access to our courts. So as part of that effort, we bring you Senate File 15, which all it does is it raises the jurisdiction in circuit court from the current level of $7,000 to $50,000. The current $7,000 circuit court limit was set in 1985. And so this is a rather dramatic increase, but it's important to note it hasn't been increased for 25 years. And this wasn't a random number. The number was developed following a 2010 workload study that shows statewide the system is short 2.73 district court judges, and that we have 2.66 extra circuit court judges, and we also have extra capacity in our circuit court clerk's offices. And it was determined that 26% of the current district court caseload are civil matters that would bounce down to circuit court. Are civil matters subject to a change of jurisdictional limit. The district court clerk's data shows that about 33% of those matters would fall under the $50,000 limit and then would shift to circuit court. And the conclusion of the judges, and there was also a discussion at the state convention of lawyers and judges to consider this issue. And it was concluded, I think, fairly substantially, although there is some dissent in this area, that the circuit court could better manage these smaller cases. These are smaller cases that by the time you expend litigation costs of district court, which involves more process, can almost make them not worthwhile to take. But the really big issue is that our district courts are overloaded, and it can take, in certain courts, particularly I think in the northern part of the state, it can take a couple years to get a trial date if you have a civil court matter. So the hope is that by shifting some of these smaller cases to the circuit court and really fulfilling the purpose of the circuit courts, which is to handle the smaller matters, that we will actually make the entire court system more workable and accessible to the public. And again, I think the key factor here is we haven't raised the jurisdiction level since 1985. And even if it were just adjusted for inflation, it probably wouldn't quite hit 50,000, but I believe it would be somewhere in the $30,000 range. 50,000 was the number chosen based on the case studies. In the past, our elected district court clerks have been a little skeptical of this, and to date I haven't heard from my own district court clerk, and I will let the body know that at least on the House side, there was no district court clerk testimony in opposition to this bill. And with that, I would stand for questions.
Majority Leader Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The circuit court caseload, as I understand it, varies from district to district to district. And we talked about that when we talked about magistrates earlier in the session. Some of the districts, the circuit courts, are full. They don't have any more capacity and any more time. Some of them aren't quite as full. When you talk about generic statistics of having too many judges in the circuit courts and not enough judges in the district courts, I'm just curious, how is there a plan to allocate circuit court judges from the districts that are less busy to the districts that are more busy so that the caseloads can be addressed?
Representative Throne, why don't you respond to that specific question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't think that's not part of this bill. That may need to be considered. And I do have a handout. I need to perhaps get copies for the body that breaks it down jurisdiction by jurisdiction, which I can share with the good majority floor leader and anyone else who is interested.
Speaker Pro Tem Gingrich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know the committee number one worked really hard during the interim on this bill. I actually rise in opposition to the bill. I will be a no on this bill, and for multiple different reasons. One being that the intent made sense to me. I kept hearing more efficiency, streamlining, making the courts effective, access to courts. The problem is I don't see how this bill does any of that. If we want to really improve our court system, we need to start looking at our discovery process. The discovery process is where things are getting slowed down, where people are doing depositions that go on forever. They depose people for a very lengthy time throughout months after month, and people are never actually getting to court. To remind you what our former Chief Justice said here one day when addressing us, the system is broke, and that people are obtaining their justice in the state of Wyoming in the back room of a Holiday Inn, meaning that they go to arbitration and mediation because our court systems are too slow and too ineffective. There are many things that could be done. This isn't one of them. And here's why this doesn't work very well. There was testimony during the interim that the 50,000, if you look at the $50,000 number, what types of cases will that be shifting from the district court level to the circuit court level? Primarily, it is collection cases. collection cases are cases that don't actually involve the work of the judge. They involve the work of the clerk. So in essence, what we're doing is shifting from the district court clerk doing a lot of work to the circuit court clerk doing a lot of work. And here's where it's important to understand the distinction between circuit courts and district courts. As you know, we have a three-tier system in Wyoming. Take municipal courts totally out of the equation. That is a separate deal. For the state of Wyoming, we have circuit courts at the bottom. They're doing your misdemeanors for criminals, and they're doing civil cases up to $7,000. Then you go to district court. They're taking everything over $7,000, and they're doing your felonies. Then you have one appeals court, being the Wyoming Supreme Court. In other states, sometimes they have a intermediate appeals court, but we don't do that. So we have a three-tier court. Here's where it gets real interesting. A few years ago, we used to have what's called a county court system. And if you didn't have a county court, you had a justice of the peace in your community. We changed that, and we shifted to a circuit court system. What that did was shift the cost to the state. So the state started paying for those circuit courts. A circuit court judge is paid as a state employee. A circuit court clerk and all of those circuit court clerk deputies are state employees. They're paid with state paychecks, state health benefits, all those items. At a district court level, the district court judge does get paid by the state, but they are independent. But the district court clerk, and here's where this all comes together, the district court clerk is actually a county employee. Actually, they're elected. They're the only constitutional county officer. All the other county officers are legislative created. District court clerks are actually in the Wyoming Constitution. They are a district court clerk manages the office independently of the district court judge, which is always somewhat unique. The district court clerk and their staff is paid for with county money. Okay, so let's say you're shifting some of these cases. And again, the majority of the cases that they brought spreadsheets and were showing, the district court clerks had gone back and said, okay, if this law had been in effect last year, what cases would have actually been shifted down to a circuit court? They would have left the district court, gone to the circuit court. Well, primarily it's collection cases. And the testimony, and it was actually somewhat humorous testimony from one particular circuit court judge, they said, how hard is a collection case? What is your role in that? And the judge said, well, the clerk brings in the file. They've been working on it for a few hours, getting all the paperwork in order. I open the file. I flip through it. The paperwork looks in order. I sign the order. I close the file, and I hand it back to the clerk. Clearly, not a lot of work goes into a collection case. The work in a collection case is done by the clerk, getting the paperwork in order. It's a very, you know, somewhat monotonous, but it's a hard, you know, you got to do it. It takes a lot of time of the court clerk, the district court clerk. What you're going to be doing is by shifting this, the district court clerks will not have as much work. So that will reduce the number of employees they will need. That's great for counties. Counties will be able to lay off deputy district court clerks. They won't need those positions anymore. Here's what's going to happen, though, in return. Your circuit court clerks will increase. So if you want to increase state government, this is your bill for you. This is the bill that will increase state government because it increases the number of circuit court clerks. Now, there was testimony that, well, we're not sure that will happen because in some jurisdictions we actually think we have enough circuit court clerks, or we may actually have more than enough. The problem is these don't shift around. I mean, so you can't look at the whole number across the state because you have maybe five clerks in this town, five clerks in this town. It's not as if they get up in the morning and go, oh, they need more help over in this town, and they travel over there, even though they do actually have one rotating clerk that travels the state when people are on sick leave and stuff. So the problem is you're potentially going to see an expansion of the circuit court clerks, which is an expansion of state government. You're going to see a decrease in the district court clerks. And that's actually not the major reason I'm against the bill. I mean, that's fine. I mean, actually, it'll save the county some money. the problem is, I'm not sure what problem this is solving. So we shifted a few collection cases from district court to circuit court. How did that make our court system more effective? How did that streamline the court system? How did that increase access to the courts? I'm not seeing that. My other concern is when you look at the distinction between a circuit court and a district court, what I'm concerned what we're doing with this bill is we're creating two court systems that are identical. If the circuit courts want to become district courts, let's just do that. Let's just say we don't have circuit courts anymore and we just have district courts across the board. There is a distinction. Circuit courts are a lower court than the district court. They're not the same. And by ratcheting it up, we start to blur the difference, and that also concerns me. Those are my major concerns with the bill. My other concern is that the other body took out what I thought was the more important part of this bill. There was a provision in there to increase small claims. I actually thought that was a great idea to increase the small claims number, because in small claims court, your discovery and your procedures are all lessened. So actually things speed along in small claims, and that's what we should be doing. We should be looking at ways to speed up the process, to make the process more efficient. Just by shifting cases, that's not going to do it.
Chairman Brown. Mr. Chairman, the testimony we heard in court was, in committee, we had a Supreme Court justice, we had a district court judge, we had a circuit court judge. The Supreme Court justice just kind of testified in favor of it. The district judge that we had is one of the district judges in this county who was a circuit court judge for 8 years and then moved to the district court. His testimony was that this would save him time. And it wasn't a great deal of time, but their time is valuable, and it's especially valuable if you've got something that's been parked on the docket for some substantial period of time. And he felt that this would relieve some burden on him. The circuit court judge said that their court system was capable of absorbing these cases. So it looked to us like it was moving part of the caseload from the district court to the circuit court. The circuit court had room for it. The judges did. They had the capacity to take it. And the district judges are backed up. That is true. And if we can save them some time, that's some time that they can spend on another case. The only other thing I'd say in response to what we just heard is the point was made, and it was well taken with me, that these circuit court judges are now lawyers. And if they're lawyers, they ought to be able to handle $50,000 cases, for Pete's sake. If they can't, why don't we just go back to JPs? But they are lawyers. They understand the rules of evidence. They understand the truncated procedures that apply in circuit court, and they certainly ought to be able to handle cases of this load. So it is true that maybe we're starting to walk the circuit courts up a little bit, but I think I'd prefer to see us walk the jurisdiction of the circuit courts up a little bit with judges who are certainly capable of handling cases up to this jurisdictional limit. The alternative would be that we start expanding the district courts, and if we expand the district courts, why then we get into more judges there. And it seemed that it would better balance the load if we move some of these cases out of the district court where they need the time, move them to circuit courts where they have plenty of capacity and the right amount of legal knowledge in order to handle the cases. So that's why we passed the bill through.
Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'll be brief. Just to follow on the good chairman of judiciary, it's important for the body to understand that we are not equalizing or making the two types of courts in any way similar, because there are certain things that the district court will continue to have to do. They will continue to have to do domestic relations cases, and they will continue to have to do felonies, and they will continue to have to do juvenile cases. And one of the points of this bill is to make it so you can get a divorce more easily, so you can get through the court system. We have a whole raft of numbers here, and I'll just pick a couple of different counties. In my county, the shift in jurisdiction would result in 24 contract cases 87 tort cases, and a total of 702 simple civil cases, which covers a variety. So you'd have 813 cases transferred to the district court. In the land of former, I don't know what to call this land, a northern county, where the good chairman of appropriations is from, where we know we have a pretty bad backlog of cases, we've moved 30 contract cases, 16 tort cases, 265 simple civil cases, and that would be a total of 311 cases transferred. That's one of our backed-up jurisdictions where I know personally it can take you 2 years to get a trial date. With regard to the issue of we need to fix our discovery process, that's entirely true, but that's unrelated to this issue. It is something the courts are undertaking and are working with a variety of groups to get some streamlined discovery in place. It's not the function of this body to fix discovery, but it is the function of this body to adjust jurisdiction as necessary, which, again, has not been adjusted since 1985.
Representative Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I would rise in favor of the bill, and I would take issue with the some of the arguments presented by the good representative from House District 23. With collection cases, in my experience, most of the work is done by the lawyers, not by the clerks. They prepare everything, they bring it, and the judge generally insists on it. And so the time, if the judge is doing it right, should be within the lawyer's pocket and not in the clerk's pocket. I don't think it'll change the number of employees for the district courts. I can imagine in a few years from now, circuit court judges may perhaps asking for more money, but that'll be a different issue down the road. But I don't think it's going to change the number of employees. As just mentioned, they are in the process of streamlining some of the discovery issues. This is just one step in a multifaceted level of trying to make the courts more accessible, and so you can't take this out of context with other things that are going on. I have cases in Casper, well, in Natrona County, in the northern part of the state, and here, where it's been sitting in front of the court for over 18 months, and we're waiting for decisions. So anything we can do to speed that process up, I think, would make for better government.
Speaker Pro Tem Gingrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to discuss some of those, I'm just recalling the testimony from the summer, and maybe new information came forward when the committee heard this the other day. The testimony we received this summer was clerks receive large mailings of collection from collection agencies, and these take a lot of time for the clerks to process. I'm sure the last speaker is correct that a lawyer wrote it, but it takes a lot of time for the clerk to actually get the file ready to present to the judge, and that the judge's role was minimal, and that was the testimony from a circuit court judge on that issue. So what I was really talking about was who, in the work capacity, it was the clerk doing most of those cases. The other part of the testimony that I recall from this summer, and that came from the district court clerks, that when you go back and you look at a lot of these cases, that the 50,000 number, all it's doing is transferring a lot of collection cases. It's not getting to the more serious cases, which are keeping the district court judges busy. I mean, that's clearly what's the problem. The district court judges have a lot on their plate. I hate to argue it this way, but truly, I mean, one of the first proposals I saw was to actually take it more to 100,000. And 100,000, you might actually start making a dent into what the district court judges are doing. But just by shifting just your collection cases down, I'm not sure it's going to accomplish what everyone seems to think it's going to accomplish. And I guess that's my biggest concern, is that everyone has sort of hung their hat on this bill as suddenly we have solved all our problems of the judicial system. And I think there are so many other things that we should be working on first, and then we can come back and look at this. And then there was the issue of circuit court judges or lawyers. and that's primarily true. We do actually have one non-lawyer serving as a magistrate in one county, which is fine. He's a great magistrate. But this does apply to the magistrates also.
Majority Leader Lubnow.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The real and true problem with district court judges is the types of cases that they have to have and their dockets and what little control they truly have over their dockets. If they have a criminal trial or a criminal case, those cases have to be tried within a period of time. And so you have to get the people in. They've got to be arraigned. They've got to have hearings. And then they have to have the trial, and that all has to be done within a certain period of time. You have juvenile cases where those are immediate types of things, where you have to be in court within 3 days. Then you have the civil commitment hearings that are in district court that have to be in court within 72 hours. So what happens is the district court judges have a hard time scheduling blocks of time for their big civil trials. And if you look at their dockets as a percentage of what they do, you will find that primarily district court judges' dockets are criminal cases, juvenile cases, and divorces, and that a very small percentage of their caseload is indeed civil court trials. It seems to me that maybe this will shift some of the burden, but in my district, the circuit court clerks are already stretched to the breaking point. The judges have no time, and we have delays in circuit court as well. Our statutes say that you need to have your forcible entry and detainer heard within 14 days. In my district, if you're in court within 2 months on an eviction proceeding, you're very, very lucky. So I agree with the Speaker Pro Tem that I don't know if there's a direct causal link between what we're trying to do here and what the results are that we want to achieve. It just is shifting collection cases from one court to another court just doesn't seem like that's going to ease anybody's workload. Now, I say that at the expense of getting a trial setting and my next setting in my district court in 2015 and getting into circuit court right away. But I guess those are the risks you take.
Minority Whip Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm noticing, as I'm sure many of you have noticed, that the only people speaking on this issue happen to have JDs after our names, and not all of us are speaking who have JDs, and I am not encouraging any of you to get up. But I would like to say to the good majority floor leader that we listened to a lot of testimony. I have a lot of statistics that I can show him, including from his own county, the land of the Powder River, where there are 187 contract cases in district court. If we assume half of those settle, half of them require a half-day trial, then we've already saved a whole bunch of days for his particular district court judge. So the folks in our court system, in conjunction with members of the bar, have worked long and hard to gather data to justify this position. They did not come to us on a whim. They came to us after much study and presented this to us as an option for improving our court system. And I would urge all of you to vote aye, and I have a whole lot of information I can share with you. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Brown's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report and do so with a recommendation that Senate file number 15 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Senate file 15 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Privilege of the floor.
Please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, it's not often my wife makes it down from snowy Riverton, but she's made it down here. She's sitting in the North Gallery Please stand up and let's greet her.
Welcome. Welcome to the house. We appreciate the relief. Thank you. Okay. Committee of the Whole, the next bill for our consideration is Senate File 17, and the reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 17, introduced by the Judiciary, an act relating to probation and parole amendments. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended that it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Barbuto, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Peasley, Throne, No, Brechtel, Excused, Brown, Signed, Representative Brechtel, Vice Chair.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 17 do pass, and I further move the Standing Committee Amendment, and I would turn it over to the representative from District 11 to explain both the bill and the Standing Committee Amendment.
Thank you, Representative Throne.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I have to wonder what I did to upset the good Chairman of Judiciary to have so much fun on a Tuesday afternoon. This is another bill from our interim study topics, and getting editorial comments here from the back of the room, Mr. Chairman. Yes, we did have an exciting interim this year. Actually, I don't mean to trivialize this bill. This subject was brought to us by the state agencies that really do have a tough job, our Department of Corrections and our Board of Parole. These are essentially streamlining provisions and to basically put into statute a lot of what they were already doing in the field to streamline the titles. There were some more contentious issues discussed over the interim, but we did not bring those forward, and they did not reappear in the Senate version. The Standing Committee Amendment, which if you flip back to page 11 of the bill, goes in at line 13. This is to clarify the notification provisions to victims. Wyoming Statute 1-40-204 is our victim notification and Bill of Rights section, and we added this in this provision of the bill to make it parallel to an earlier provision in the bill. And with if there are no questions on the Standing Committee Amendment, I'd call for the question.
You've heard the motion on the Standing Committee Amendment. All those in favor of Standing Committee Amendment number 1, please say aye. Opposed, say no. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 17 has been adopted. We are back on the bill. Representative Throne.
Mr. Chairman, again, I'll be brief, but essentially this is the purpose of this bill is to implement a lot of practices and to clarify the statute to allow more efficient management of the parolees and probationers. Was not opposed by any groups. Again, the difficult issues with local law enforcement were worked out over the summer. Victims' rights to restitution are protected. Clarifications are made regarding good time allowance. There's a definition in here for good time allowances, which again is consistent with practice. It provides for specific provisions that, again, were in practice, but maybe not clearly in statute, as to when a parolee or a probationer could be picked up and how that process would work. And since we fascinated all of you with the last bill, I am sort of rushing through this one, but I would stand for questions.
Any further discussion? Any further discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Brown's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report to do so with a recommendation that bill number 17 do pass, please say aye. Opposed, say no. Senate File 17 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 22. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 22, introduced by the Judiciary Committee, an act relating to wind energy property rights. This bill was referred to Committee Number 1, Judiciary, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Barbuto, Brown, Kennedy, Green, Crone, Nicholas, Peasley, Throne. No, Brechtel. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Chairman Brown?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File Number 22 do pass, and I will explain the bill. Mr. Chairman, this comes out of many, many years of experience in this state with split estates. I hope we all know that the mineral estate and the surface estate are separable, and that once they're separated, we have what we call split estates. The mineral estate is the dominant estate. That has good public policy reasons far back in history to justify it, but nonetheless, over the years, it has caused no end of grief and heartburn. So now we come forward to the modern era and the modern concept of wind development, and the question is, and this is a public policy question, decision that we're making, the question is, are we going to have another form of split estate? In other words, would we allow a surface owner to sever the wind estate? So then you could potentially have two split estates, three separate estates in a piece of property. You could have the mineral estate, which is dominant, the surface estate, and then a wind estate. And if the wind estate were severed, then the further question would arise, would the wind estate be dominant over the surface estate? Would it be subservient to the mineral estate and vice versa? And I think the number of combinations of that is 9 factorial. So this was a bill that was developed by the Joint Judiciary Interim Committee. They had taken a lot of testimony on it. And the product of that was this bill, which essentially says that we are not going to allow this wind estate to be severed from the surface estate. And I think that in Wyoming, we can all understand that, having all the experience that we have with mineral estates. So that's what this bill does, Mr. Chairman. And just in short order, on page 2, it contains the definitions of wind energy agreement, wind energy developer, wind energy right, and this act. Then at the top of page 3 is where the bill says wind energy right shall be regarded as an interest in real property and a pertinent to the surface estate. And then paragraph B that starts on line 5 and page 3 says wind energy rights shall not be severed from the surface estate, except that wind energy may be developed pursuant to a wind energy agreement. The fine line that this bill walks is between not allowing a severance but still allowing an agreement for the development of the wind energy. Paragraph C, line 9 on page 3 says a wind energy agreement is an interest in real property, and that agreement shall be recorded in the office of the county clerk and shall include a description of the land subject to the agreement. That is so that all persons who are interested in the title or who are going to take the title have constructive notice of the wind energy agreement and a way to find it. Then subparagraph D that starts on line 20 on page 3 simply says that if there is a wind energy agreement and it's recorded at the time that it terminates, upon request of the property owner sent by registered mail, that the wind energy developer will record a release so that it clears that cloud on the chain of title. And if the wind energy developer fails to file a release, then they would be subject for all costs that a surface owner might suffer in the future because it's still there. Paragraph E says wind energy itself becomes personally at the point of conversion into electricity. In other words, it's at that point no longer pertinent to the real property, so that we have a line of demarcation, kind of like we have at the heater treater, I think, on some kinds of oil wells. It's the same concept. Then paragraph F, which starts on line 16, talks about wind energy agreements or conveyances made prior to April 1, 2011, which is the proposed effective date of this bill, And so nothing in this bill would disturb those. There are some out now that have been split. And we can't make an ex post facto law. We have to recognize that those exist, and we have to protect those. But it does require them to file a notice of the agreement, the same as any new agreement that would be entered into, and they have to file that notice by July the 1st of 2011. Then a series of references to other areas of the law, beginning actually at line 24 on page 4 and carrying over the top of page 5, it makes it clear it doesn't disturb the dominance of the mineral estate. Then the next section that starts at line 6 on page 5 makes it clear that nothing herein will diminish the compensation in an eminent domain action that should be paid for a piece of property, and it really allows that compensatory mechanism to take into account the value of the wind estate. And then we get the section that starts on line 17 on page 5. Nothing in this act shall be construed to restrict the transfer of a wind energy agreement, including the transfer of a surface owner's rights to receive the payments. And then the final section, which essentially starts at the top of page 6, provides that unless it's otherwise agreed between the surface owner and the wind energy developer, easements acquired after the effective date of this bill, April 1, 2011, will revert to the surface owner if the wind energy production has ceased for a continuous period of 10 years or if generation of electricity by a turbine is not commenced within 20 years after execution of the agreement. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the bill, and I'd stand for any questions.
Representative Varnish.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Brown, I have one question. You talked about using registered mail, and typically I think registered mail is used by jewelers to send rings and other valuable substances. Would certified mail meet the same purpose?
We'll go. Chairman Brown, if you could just answer that before we move on.
Mr. Chairman, the answer to that is that's true. Registered mail is insured. Certified mail requires a return receipt. I think I'd have to go look. I'm pretty sure there's something in the statute someplace that says that certified mail and registered mail are equivalent for purposes of notices under the statutes. I'm pretty sure there's something like that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Minority Leader Goggles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question for clarification. In 3427103, Declaration of Wind Rights, and the 3427104 dominions of mineral estate. Can you explain the difference between those two, Representative, between the wind energy right and the mineral dominance?
Representative Korberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I guess my first question was, I only have one. Did the committee discuss at all language or changes that had come over from Senate and Gross that was on the original interim bill? And if they did, I have a question on part of the language that was deleted.
Chairman Brown.
Mr. Chairman, we did not discuss that, but if there's a question, I'd be happy to try to address it.
Representative Korberger.
Mr. Chairman, I might just ask the good chairman of Judiciary that then on my own, since this is language that the rest of the body has not seen.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Chairman Brown.
Mr. Chairman, then the answer to the question about the wind energy rights and the mineral estate. This bill recognizes that wind energy rights are a separate stick in the bundle. And now I recognize that, but then in the part back here on eminent domain says, if this property is condemned in eminent domain, there's a value to that stick in the bundle that's to be recognized. And that is the part in 3427105 that starts on line 6 on page 5. The part about the dominance of the mineral estate simply says, okay, that's another stick in the bundle, but reaffirms that the dominance over all those sticks in the bundle, the estate that trumps everything, if it needs to be developed, is the mineral estate. And so it would trump the surface estate. The other stick in the bundle, which I don't want to call a wind estate, I guess, but I think it is a wind estate. It's just not severable. So there's a surface estate, a wind estate. They're not severable, but they both exist as separately recognized sticks in the bundle, and the mineral estate would take dominance over both of them.
Any further discussion? Any further discussion? Question being called. All those in favor of Representative Brown's motion? Now, when the committee of the whole rises to report to do so with a recommendation that Bill number 22 do pass, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Senate File 22 has passed the committee of the whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 23. The reading clerk will please read the bill.
Senate File 23, introduced by the Corporation Committee, an act relating to mail ballot elections. This bill was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes with amendments. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illoway, Yagi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Shepperson, Stubson, signed Representative Illoway, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Chairman Illoway?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 23 do pass, and I further move the adoption of the Standing Committee Amendment. Standing Committee Amendment is to take out on page 6, lines 1 through 12. This was a section put in by the other body. We did not feel in committee that it made a whole lot of sense the way it was put together. Didn't think that it was necessary, so we took it out. And I'd call for the question on the Standing Committee Amendment.
Question being called on Standing Committee Amendment number 1. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The Standing Committee Amendment's been adopted. We're back on the bill. Chairman Illoway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, this bill is easier to track if you start at page 6. What happened, there was an election in the center of the state a while back, and there are no rules on redo elections. It turned out that part of the election, portion of the election was declared void, and it had to be redone. There were no guidelines unless the judge spelled it out. And so this bill was put together by the clerks and Secretary of State, and it does give some direction and some options. Sometimes mail ballot elections are necessary. In this particular one, they spent about $17,000 for judges at the polls and equipment. Had they been able to do it by the mail ballot, it would have cost about a third of that. But as I indicated on page 6, it starts election declared null and void. The special election shall be held if necessary no later than the third Tuesday after the primary election and may be held by a special mail ballot election as provided. And then it goes on page 7. It talks about the special election shall be held if necessary on the third Tuesday after the general election. The special election down at the bottom of page 7 shall be conducted by the county clerk as nearly as possible in the manner of a general election. On the back, on page 8, a court-ordered election may be held by special mail ballot election as determined by the county clerk or by the Secretary of State if the election involves more than one county. Then you go over to the beginning on page 1, and these are the sections that were created, and it talks about special mail ballot elections and procedures, and it goes through for the next 4.5 or 5 pages on the procedure to handle a mail ballot. And rather than to take a lot of time, unless there are questions, I'll stand for questions. I'd call for the question.
Representative Goggles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question regarding the special election. Is this a election? It's either a mail election, M-A-I-L, or an election that would have polling places. Can you have both, or is it one or the other?
Chairman Illinois.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, this is an M-A-I-L election. It's done by mail ballot. There is no option. It's either a mail ballot or it isn't.
Further discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Illaway's motion that when the committee of the whole rises to report to do so with the recommendation that Senate file 23 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Senate file 23 has passed the House. The next bill for our consideration is Senate file 28. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate file 28, introduced by the Travel Committee, an act relating to workers' compensation for state parks volunteers. This bill was referred to committee number 6, Tribal Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Botten, Connolly, Davison, Yeagie, McKim, McComey, Petroff, Shepperson, signed Representative McComey, Chairman.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 28 do pass. And I will turn the explanation of the bill over to the good lady from House District 16, the Peaks Above the Lakes.
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You all have in your boxes a fact sheet for Senate File 28 with some information about state park volunteers. The history behind this bill, our Wyoming Workers' Compensation Fund is required for all private employers as well as public employees. The employers pay in according to a rating system based on the hazardous nature of the occupation, and then every year the rates are adjusted according to how many claims there have been. Many volunteers for state agencies are covered under workers' compensation, and the way it works is the department for which the volunteer is volunteering pays into the workers' compensation fund in order to cover those individuals. And some examples of department agencies that are currently covered under the workers' compensation are firefighters and search and rescue, game and fish volunteers, law enforcement aides, school to work programs, and various other volunteer programs. So what the bill itself does, in section 2414108, it's listing some of the types of people that can be covered under workers' compensation. And then on page 2, lines 2 and 3, it's adding to the volunteers for Wyoming Game and Fish, it's adding, or Wyoming Department of State Parks and Cultural Resources. Now, the state parks used to pay into this fund, and they used to cover their employees until workers' compensation discovered that they were not covered under the statutes. So this is really just kind of a fix. They did go a number of years without covering employees because of that, or without covering volunteers, rather. But in the budget cuts of the last couple of years, they've gotten really creative about ways to staff their organization. And in that creativity, they have hired a volunteer coordinator, and they've ramped up their volunteer efforts. And so this is part of that coordinated effort to add volunteers to their forces. Even though you will see a fiscal note, there is no appropriation requested, because I think the hope is that in these volunteer efforts that we'll be able to eliminate man hours for paid staff. So with that, I will stand for any questions.
Further discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with a recommendation that Senate File 28 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Senate File 28 has passed the House. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 32. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 32, introduced by the Travel Committee, an act relating to off-road state park trails, vehicle trails. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Botten, Connolly, Davison, Yagi, McKim, McComey, Petroff, Shepperson, sign representing McComey, Chairman.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Report of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 32 do pass. And, Mr. Chairman, I would like to turn the explanation of the bill over to the good gentleman from House District 25.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill comes as a result of interim committee work. Senate File 32 is a cleanup. It's a cleanup bill, ladies and gentlemen, meant to conform the statutes to the terminology used by some of the other agencies who participate with the state in the off-road recreational vehicle program. You'll see at the bottom of page one of the very short bill the definition of off-road recreational vehicle as, or vehicle trail as, an off-road recreational vehicle trail or area specifically designated, marked, or signed by the Department of State Parks and Cultural Resources as a Wyoming off-road recreational vehicle trail. Well, it happens that some other agencies are also joining the trail program. The federal agency in charge of managing our forests defines an off-road trail as a route 60 inches wide, and they label it as such on some of their maps and regulations. Wyoming counties are enrolling some of their roads, their county roads, in the trails program as well. The situation is that for riders of off-road recreational vehicles, they're required by statute to purchase a decal and display it on their off-road recreational vehicle. They need to know when they're on an off-road vehicle trail. So, inserting the words route and road to the statutory definition of what an off-road recreational vehicle trail is will clear up a lot of confusion for the users of the trail system. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would stand for questions or call for the question.
Any further discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 32 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 32 has passed the House. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 31. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 31, introduced by the Travel Committee, an act relating to motor vehicles, off-road vehicle definition. This bill was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Botten, Davison, Yagi, McKim, McComey, Petroff, Shepperson. No, Connolly, sign representing McComey, Chairman.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 31 do pass. And I will turn the explanation over of the bill over to the good lady from House District 20.
Representative Davison.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We bring this bill, Senate File 31, to this body to update definitions in Wyoming statutes, in particular the definition of Type 1 off-road recreational vehicles. This is an interim committee-sponsored bill. And you all have a handout on your desk that's called All-Terrain Vehicles. And that kind of explains what we're trying to do here. The need to update these statutes is because our constituents are demanding innovative products that are safer and easier to handle and that provide access to all of our thousands of miles of trails. What this bill does is simply the existing laws are antiquated, and this is just updating them to meet the machines that are being made today. The meat of the bill is on page 2, lines 9 through 16, and what it does is increase the weight from 900 pounds to 1,100 pounds, and most importantly, removes the other antiquated descriptors such as tire width, PSI, the seating configuration, the wheel rim size. We heard testimony in committee and over the interim from manufacturers and the state trail director in support of this bill. Nothing in this bill will allow an inappropriate sized vehicle on trails that are not suitable for the vehicle. This will allow machines that are 50 inches wide or less to have a seating configuration as a side-by-side to operate on our Type 1 trails. The market share of these side-by-sides over traditional four-wheelers is increasing yearly. And in 2010, for one of the major market share manufacturers, the side-by-sides and are just even with four-wheelers right now. We heard testimony about intergenerational enjoyment of these projects, grandparents enjoying the traditional outdoors adventures with their grandkids, and these are a much safer vehicle, and the riding experience is much nicer for them. And I would just urge your support for this bill. And I stand for questions.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I look at this bill, I think there's some really, really, really important words in there. For instance, what's being stricken is ridden aside of the seat or saddle to travel at least 3 low-pressure tires, and we go on to describe what low-pressure means. Rim diameter of 12 inches. I think we were really into this at the time we were originally creating this statute, and I'd urge your no vote on this proposed amendment to do some updating that is probably not necessary because everybody knows how to ride astride or in a saddle on a vehicle.
Representative Coker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I can address some of these issues since I do own a business that sells these vehicles. At the time that the statute was written, every single ATV type of vehicle was one that you sat astride on. Now there are some that you actually sit in a seat similar to how you would operate a car. So there is reason for doing that. It clears up that these other recreational vehicles fit even if you're not not riding astride.
Further discussion on the bill. Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 31 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay.
Nay.
Senate File 31 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 41. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 41, introduced by the Travel Committee, an act relating to travel and tourism regarding film industry financial incentives program. This bill was referred to committee number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources, which recommended it do pass. Ayes, Bonner, Botten, Connolly, Davison, Yagi, McKim, McComey, Petrov, Shepperson. Signed, Representative McComey, Chairman.
Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with the recommendation that Senate File 41 do pass. And I'd like to turn the explanation of the bill over to the good gentleman from House District 30.
Representative Botten.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my pleasure to present to you Senate File 41, Film Industry Financial Incentive Program, also known as FIFI, but it should be considered to be renamed something about John Wayne Fund in the future to avoid poodle jokes. But this is a bill, if you don't know, FIFI is going to expire in June. It is a bill intended to remove the sunset and to create a new fund where monies can be used and carried over that are currently allocated to FIFI. Now, the purpose of FIFI was it was an economic development program. It was designed to lure motion picture industries to Wyoming, provide jobs, have them spend money in our state, have them hire people in our state, in essence, leave a lot of money here, and to also encourage tourism by making Wyoming a very beautiful place in the films to come visit, thereby attracting more money to our state. And, of course, tourism is the number two industry in our state. This FIFI program began in 2007, and you have a handout that's been placed in your box. It has a few movie title pictures on the back end. Some of the ones that have brought attention to Wyoming and at least people say has attracted tourists to come here. Currently, the FIFI program has 1.2 million in the program, which if it's allowed to sunset would come back and the program would finish. This bill would change the, extend the program indefinitely, take that $1.2 million, put it into the FIFI account so the program can continue. The economic development since 2007 has been, or the economic effect, has been the expenditure by motion picture businesses in Wyoming of about $2 million, $1 million of which was in wages for Wyoming people. The rest of it was gasoline and motels and food and other expenditures in mom-and-pop operations right here in Wyoming. In order to attract those motion picture businesses, FIFI paid out in excess of $500,000. Now, I think it's self-explanatory, the handout. I think I could try to answer more of your questions, but this last 20 minutes has been provided to you by the travel committee, and it's been a pleasure. I'll stand for your questions.
Representative Stubson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question, and it goes to really the first statement the good gentleman from up north made, which is this was designed to be an incentive to bring in the film industry. And I recall a couple sessions ago, initially the eligibility was you had to spend $500,000 in the state in order to be eligible for the incentive. And then we lowered it, I think, two or three sessions ago to $200,000 because there had been so little interest in the $500,000 threshold. And immediately after we did that, as I recall, there were five applicants for it, four who had already filmed, had filmed when they weren't even eligible for the incentive. We ended up paying out money to them as part of this incentive when it's clear they would have been here no matter whether the incentive existed or not. And so my question really goes to, is there any evidence that this is actually bringing the film industry into the state, or are we just sort of giving money away to those that would otherwise come here?
Representative Madden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had the same question that the good representative from 56 just talked about. But in addition to that, I have another question. I want to know what it is that feeds this new fund. Now, I know what the initial one is. It's money that's left over from past time periods, past years, where people either haven't asked for this money or there hasn't been any film activity. But looking at this, you know, we set this up. Is this going to be some kind of a budgetary deal we have to have? Is this part of the standard budget? Or what is it that feeds this besides general funds? And, you know, is there any direct payback to this fund from I guess, what I would call fund operations or the activities generated by some film being made here, I guess. I'd just like to have a little background on where this is taking us, because we're setting up some kind of a fund that I want to make sure we're not building in some kind of a long-term budgetary obligation. Thank you.
Representative Croker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess what I would like to know is why we think, or where in the Constitution it gives gives us the right to take money from the general fund and give it to a private business who's operating for profit. I just don't see any role in that. A lot of the other incentives we've given effectively involve tax breaks, where we're, if a new industry comes, we're exempting them from some of the taxes that they would pay. But that is drastically different from taking money, taxpayers' money, and giving it to a private for-profit company. So I guess I don't see anywhere that we have a right to do that, and nor should we. And if we do, then I'm kind of wondering where the I'm a business owner who moved to this state to employ people. So where was my big fat check? I don't understand how we can give it to one industry and not another.
Chairman Korberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question on obviously page 2, but it's lines 7 and 8. And I just think that maybe that language might need some clarification, because to me it's funds in the account are continuously appropriated. That makes it, I don't know if that sounds like there's always going to be money in that account that's continuously going to that, I mean, that continuously appropriated, and then to the board, we generally appropriate funds to a program, not to a board. So that might just be maybe a technical correction, a little cleanup that we might need to do on second reading, because I think that's not very clear. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Botten, do you have your legs under you there?
Mr. Chairman, how is it working? I'll allow the good lady behind me to answer that one. How is it funded? This program would have to come to the appropriations process and ask for money, just like every other program. The starting would be the 1.2 that's already there would be transferred over to that fund for use. As to the issue of where is this in the Constitution, don't have time to look it up right now. I sure hope that work was done 4 years ago when this whole thing was enacted to begin with, so I hope so. Can this be done through a tax break instead of a credit, or rather a refund? The answer probably is no, because the motion picture industry that comes to Wyoming to do this work isn't paying any tax here, income tax or whatnot, except with respect to sales tax. So if we were to refund their sales tax, we're just cutting our own throats of our own people who are providing them services and products and so forth. And the wording on page 2 at line 7 and 8, maybe I'd suggest if that's a problem, that maybe an amendment on that could clean up some language. I think the intent was that the money goes into the account and it's going to be available for the board to use in the fee program without any additional steps that's not already in the program. And I'll yield to the good lady from my county to explain whether this program has worked over the last 4 years.
Representative Chairman Berger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I wanted to start with a couple of things that most of you haven't gotten too connected with me since I've been down the hall for so many weeks, but I was in business for 25 years, and a lot of what I did was volunteer work, too, on the side, and I did a lot of community work with locations, so that's important for you to know with the film industry. And what I saw happen as the director of one of our business organizations in our community was it really stimulated our economy, and it excited our young people, and it created jobs, and it filled hotels and restaurants. And so over the years, I saw the benefit of it as a business person. And then had the opportunity to work on the original FIFI. The money originally in the account, which as of when we made an appropriation, was $1.8 million. And as of 12/31, we had $1.2 million in there. So I think, you know, we could look at changing the continuing language. But the idea is just to have whatever is left at the end of that biennium roll into the next one with a report and with a request for additional money if it were available. So that decision does get made in Joint Appropriations Committee. the idea is that if the money goes away, then you can't incentivize. And we are, people will ask, well, why do you do an incentive program? Well, 45 out of 50 states do it. So if we're not in the game, we don't even have that opportunity. The reason that I've been a strong proponent of it, it has to do with the marketing aspect of the state of Wyoming. What I have seen from the film industry is how it promotes our state. And at the same time, what I see when I'm sitting on appropriations is the amount of money that we spend on advertising and marketing within our tourism agency. And I feel that this is more tangible and that I've seen the benefit in my community and I think around the state of Wyoming. The other thing that's come from this in developing the film incentive program is we've created programs at our community colleges, and we're strengthening that. And we're actually now seeing, because of the number of projects that we have had, which at our smaller scale, that was mentioned about the amount of $500,000, reducing it to $200,000. What we really hoped that we could get bigger projects in. At the time that we really started to get into this was the downturn in the economy. And believe me, no one on the West Coast was doing productions. So we looked at this level of 200, and they have to show all receipts, and they have to be identified within the state of Wyoming. Some of us have worked with folks who worked on past projects, and they did not qualify. I was not involved in the selection committee as they made the decision on some of the projects that had started and we funded. So I cannot answer that component of it for today. But my whole endeavor has been for new projects and to increase jobs in Wyoming and exposure to the state of Wyoming.
Mr. Minority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have two questions. One, if you could clarify the word films for me so I could know who the users are of this fund. And second is, some of those users may be sort of like in a commercial type. And in northern part of my county, there's some folks that train horses that appear on a commercial during this one football game at the end of the professional season, and they served as beverage. Are those some of the users that utilize this fund?
Representative Petroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't believe that that specific use that you're discussing was one of the funds. I think there were five projects that were funded so far. The concept initially was to develop a large pool of money, and that's why the money rolls over every year, because as the good chair of revenue mentioned, most other states that have any viable film industry offer incentives. And if we are to be at all competitive, we have to be able to offer these incentives. But to be able to do it at the volume to attract major motion pictures, we have to be able to have a large enough pool. So that's why this money it stays in the account. And they are very careful about how they appropriate it. It has to be, when they're reviewing a project, they look at how much money is going to be spent in the state, how they review every single receipt for what was spent in the state, and they also take into account whether or not the state is going to be represented in the film. Is it just filmed here? And there's certainly an advantage to having jobs here and to having it be filmed. But do we also get an advertising benefit of it? And that is a consideration as to how much of a rebate they get. There are some figures here that 1 hour of programming shown once on National Geographic equates to the equivalent of $150,000 to $175,000 worth of advertising. And on PBS, $75,000. So there are just a multitude of ways that this benefits the state, and I encourage you to support the bill.
Chairman Illaway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, there were two handouts in your basket that pretty well answers the questions that have been answered. And it really goes down, how has it been used? There are five completed FIFI projects. It lists those projects. How much was there? $554,000 has been rebated to production companies. Then it says production companies have to spend a minimum of $200,000 to qualify. and to receive a cash rebate of up to 15%. This has been a good project, a program, and if you take a look at one of these on the back, you'll see the projects that have been used. I'm probably older than a bunch of you in here, but I do remember, and I have to. There was a wonderful film that was produced in the far off county, and it was a wonderful film, and I think it's been used many, many, many times and advertised the state, and it's noticed on the back of that sheet. I just think that this is a great way to let folks around the world know about Wyoming. It has, if you'll notice on these sheets, FIFI allows Wyoming to compete with other programs that exist worldwide, including 40 other states. We just worked on a bill today in one of the committees from down the hall, and we talked about the data centers. Wyoming is small in what we try to do, and somehow we have to get our name out, and the best way to get our name out is, in some cases, is to show it. And our scenery is second to none. And if this is the way to do it, it's a small price to pay to let the state of Wyoming be known. On and for the bill.
Representative Edmonds.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think my question is more, how do we gauge real success? Because we appropriated 1.8, and I remember the debate in 2007. And since then, if my calculations are correct, we've spent $600,000 of it, which is an average rate of $150,000 a year. So at the current balance that they have, $1.2 million, it'll take them 10 years to spend what we have. And I know a previous speaker said that we needed to build this pool to attract films, but I've looked over the films that we've attracted, don't really know any of them. So I'm just wondering how, you know, if we're now going to make this major policy change and say that we're going to put this into the budget and allow it to be in the budget, I have no problem with removing the sunset, repealing that section, but having all these funds revert and stay into a pool, that means we really need to have some mechanism to judge whether this program is working or it isn't. And what does working mean? How many jobs are we creating? How much money are we bringing to the state? Are these films really doing what we are saying they're doing? Because this is $1.2 million, and I suspect that if we put it into the budget, they're going to come and ask for more. And how much more? Where does it end, and how do we judge it? I'm not terribly excited or really wanting to support the bill as it is now. I would certainly support repealing the sunset. Nobody's saying that the program isn't trying, but it's been 4 years. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Mr. Speaker, pro tem.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to deal with the constitutional issue first, it's in Article 16. As most of you know, we have Article 16, Section 6, that says you can't give money except it's for the poor. We then came back and did one a few years. Well, it's been quite a few years now. And it's how the Business Council actually operates. That's how you can do business parks in your community. It's how you can do business-ready communities is under that constitutional amendment. So it's clearly constitutional. And then later we passed another one. I think it actually was the Speaker's, one of his very first bills that actually went on to the Constitution, that counties can actually do the same type of thing with economic development. So it comes under that provision. So the constitutional issues handled. I just wanted to talk a little bit about I represent one small town in Fremont County that a movie was made pretty recently about where a young man is killed in Iraq, and then it's the story of it bringing home his body to the hometown and how the hometown responds to that. It was actually filmed in the state north of us. It's a film all about Wyoming. It's a film all about a young man. It was a true story, a young man that died in Iraq that was from our state, and it was actually all filmed in Montana for a lot of different reasons. And it's important to understand that it's not just the incentive aspect. One of the major reasons it was actually filmed in Montana is the university there that is just north of the park. They have a large film program there. So they actually have college kids that can serve as crew. Finding a crew is actually a major part of the issue. And the community college in the center of our state has been working on building up crews, because that's one of the first questions If you've ever, they come to our town a lot on these what's called FAM tours, familiarization tours, and major companies will come, and they're trying to determine where to film certain scenes. And one of the first questions they'll ask is about crew, and luckily that community college in the center of our state is working on building up that capacity. The other community I represent, Jackson, they actually do have quite a few people actually there that that can serve as crew. But that's been one of the harder parts because they don't like to fly in a full crew to do all the filming. And then the major part is, and I think the chairman of appropriations pointed this out, 45 other states have incentive programs. So you get into this competition thing with incentives, and there's one state that is, two states south of us, that really has a high incentive program. So a lot of movies that would have been filmed here actually get filmed there because they have a bigger incentive program. And I'm not saying expand the incentive program, but that certainly is something that keeps weighing into their decision-making is that aspect. As to some of the actual movies that have been done so far, one of those, they're on the list, and it's a ski movie, but it sounds like it might be about submarines, actually. It's actually a ski movie. It's actually served a great purpose in that it is one of the most popular movies with 20-year-olds all around the country. It gets shown at college campuses quite a lot. And what it does, because most of it was filmed in the major ski area of the state, a lot of people then, especially 20-year-old kids, want to come to my community. Again, our second largest industry in this state is tourism. It encourages people to come to the state and particularly to come and ski in the wintertime. And that movie has been a huge seller, encouraging people to come because they see that it's mostly pretty radical stunts that people do off cliffs and things like that. But anyway, people want to come do it. This other one that you see that has the title of my town in it, that one actually was filmed with a pretty famous country singer. It gets played on a IMAX type theater. It actually may not actually be IMAX, but similar to that. And actually it's very popular and people come to see that all throughout the summer time. Clearly, we want to have more. That's not enough. But it's a hard industry to break into. It's hard to build. The film industry is all about relationships and building relationships. And we have a wonderful young lady that is in charge of this program over at the Business Council, and she's building these relationships. But it takes a while. It takes a while to learn who all the players are. Prove to them that we actually do know what we're doing, that they're not going to lose money when they come here. They've certainly been having lots of discussions, and particularly about commercials in my hometown. Commercials seem to be more what we're going to be maybe bringing in for right now. It's hard to bring a full feature-length movie to this state. And again, it may not actually have anything to do with the incentive. It has to do a lot to do with the capacity of finding a crew. But I would encourage you to vote aye on this bill.
Chairman McComey.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, on one of the handouts is just one little couple lines there that right in the middle of it, some people don't seem to have noticed. And it talks about that the production companies have to spend a minimum of $200,000 to qualify to receive a cash rebate of up to 15%. And those ranges usually run from between 12 and 15%, as somebody else has already said, depending on how much of it takes place in Wyoming and this type of thing. But 15%, and it's a cash rebate. They have to spend all that money first before they ever receive anything back from the state of Wyoming and from the program. And right now there's 13 applications. And many of these are from anything from small people trying to do these films that we see a lot of on YouTube and some of these things anymore, to more that's going to be on public television, to those that we'll see on maybe the big silver screens someplace. But this is about the exposure of Wyoming. This is part of the tourism This is under our tourism section of the business who operates with in conjunction with the business council. We actually separated that out here not too long ago. But that's what this is all about. It's a great program, and I think it does a lot for Wyoming. It's hard to measure some of these things sometimes, but they build. I liken it to a snowball that you start at the top of the hill and you start it rolling down, and hopefully by the time it gets to the bottom of the hill, we're going to have some really major things and great things happening here. In addition to the fact that our community colleges are now starting to get involved in this, and young people are able to learn another kind of trade, and they can go a long ways. On and for the bill.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And was just mentioned, the program had its origins with the Business Council. It was transferred a couple years ago to the Wyoming Division of Tourism. The board that is referred to in the bill is the Wyoming Board of Tourism. And there is somewhat of a subjective determination that the board makes on who is eligible. After you have made the $200,000 level expenditure in qualified expenditures in Wyoming, the board looks at applicants and answers this question. What would have widespread public appeal and would likely encourage the public to visit Wyoming? There's that direct tie-in again to tourism and visitation, and that's why it's with the Board of Tourism. The question was asked, do these films or projects just get to $200,000 and automatically they have qualified for a rebate? The question was asked of the Division of Tourism in committee, and in testimony the answer was this: no, that not every, there is not just an automatic qualification. There are 13 applicants, as it has been said. Only five have been funded so far, and they have to demonstrate to the Board of Tourism that they have met the conditions that are set out in statute. So I am favorable to the program, and thank you, sir.
Representative Bond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Follow up to a question: how do we gauge the success of this thing? And that's a fair question. Over 4 years, the past 4 years, in excess of $500,000 is spent. We've talked about the $1 million in wages that have been paid to Wyoming people, and the extra $1 million on top of that for goods and services purchased from Wyoming businesses. That cost $500,000. Well, one way to look at it, and I'll offer you this, is if you end up having to pay certain television networks to air an hour of Wyoming promotional information, that would cost about, in your handouts, $150,000 to $175,000 for that hour. Another at network, maybe $75,000. The idea with these movies is that you get some recognition for the state. It's not just an hour. It's whenever it's played for all those people. And then when it goes on DVD and so forth, it just keeps on producing. The question was asked about accountability. Is there no accountability here whatsoever? Well, there is a board that monitors the processes of applying for the funds and as well as dispensing the funds, checking receipts, so forth. And also, this board has to report annually to the Joint Appropriations and Joint TRW. So I think that answers that question. Thank you for the good representative to explain the constitutionality thing. I got stuck on that. My apologies. I'm not sure if my friend from my county is wanting to talk. Okay.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I just on the accountability basis, we do receive a report. The last one was dated September 30th. It is required to be submitted to the Minerals Committee and also the JAC Committee on that, with all the accounting, all the projects, and all the people that participate in reviewing the grant applications. Thank you, and I ask for a favorable aye.
Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman McComey's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Senate File 41 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 41 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 110. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate Bill 110, introduced by the Appropriation Committee, an act relating to School Capital Construction Commission reorganization. This bill was referred to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, which recommended that it do pass. Ayes, Berger, Edmonds, Esquivel, Harshman, Pedersen, Stewart, Wallace. Signed, Representative Berger, Chairman.
Chairman Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, do so with the recommendation that Bill Number Senate File 110 do pass, and I defer to the good co-chairman of the Select Committee on School Facilities.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I'm passed out. I think it's three pages front to back. This is a 36-page bill, but it's really a pretty simple bill, and I think I can take this to you through this without too much pain. We all do. Members, also, there's a map that just hit your tray. It's got the 7 appointment districts. There'll be some questions, I'm sure. What districts, what are these districts look like? This is similar to other commissions and agencies in our state government. Ladies and gentlemen, Senate File 110 is really a result of a directive from legislation that this body passed last session, where we put the director and the agency underneath the direct control of the governor until we came up with a reorganization plan. Currently, all the statutes talk about the commission basically in charge. The commission actually picks the director. And we had a system where really the commission was charged in law to do everything, but in reality, it was staff here in Cheyenne that were kind of running the thing, and there was very little legislative oversight. And I mean very little. And just two bienniums ago, we appropriated, there was $400 million appropriated in one biennium with very little legislative oversight. All of you have come from communities. If you've been in this body for 4 years or longer, 3 or 4 years, you've all had schools that were on the list, planned up, maybe even designed, and then off the list. And there became this, what is going on? And so the legislature felt and the leadership felt that we're going to get a little better grasp on how we have spent $1.3 billion over the last decade. And there's a lot of history to this. The commission was developed, of course, to move it out of the legislature and not make us the de facto commission and come down to who could have 31 votes, whether or not you had a school. And we didn't want that system. So we designed this airplane, tinkered with it while it was flying. But I think we've come to a place now with two audits, a lot of work over the last 2 years, and I think we've come to a place where we have a pretty good product. Now, with that, it's pretty simple. We simply have the commission, and all these 36 pages are basically delegating or delineating. The commission sets this policy, and the department will come in and execute that and run the administrative part of it. So the commission then is appointed by the governor. That's a change. The current statute, the way we've done it, is 4 from the governor and 3 from the superintendent of schools. The governor will appoint all 7. We do have a stipulation that 4 of those 7 will have some expertise, architectural, construction, engineering, and a school superintendent. But we have them from those 7 districts, which I think is key. And currently, that is not the case. There's no kind of geographic representation on the commission as it stands now. So that's one change. And then the other big change really is that the director works at the pleasure of the governor, like the rest of the department heads in this state. And it's been problematic to have an agency that is generally $200 to $300 million per biennium with really no executive branch oversight. And so I think we've fixed all those things now. The first, first thing I would show you the map on the appointment districts. You can see where you're at. That's similar to Game and Fish, other commissions. The handout has bullet points. And Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm sensitive to the mood of the floor, and I've given you a lot of good information here. It's 5 pages back to back into 3. I'm not sure I want to read the whole thing to you, but I've given you the highlights that basically now the commission will be appointed by the governor, approved by the Senate, 7 members. The state superintendent is the ex officio member, so there'll be 8 on the commission. The governor appoints the director, serves at his pleasure. Commission is in charge of developing policy and all those things, and the director is, and the agency is simply to administer those policies. So I would stand for any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Connolly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just a quick question for the good presenter. I'm curious what will happen to the current decisions of the School Facilities Commission. And we all know that there are long lists of schools where they stand. Some of them are in the budget. Some of them aren't. You talk about this as a fix for some of the problems with the current system. But what will happen to the decisions that have been made up to this point?
Representative Harsh.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for that question. And we actually have another bill coming through that will clarify the scoring mechanism. And that has been some of the angst in our districts by our locals. As I mentioned in the opening, that you're on the list, you're off the list. And we've kind of got a handle on that, I think, in our last 2 years of work. And to answer your question specifically, the list will not change. We continue. We work and budget off the 09 list, and now we've built a supplemental off the 2010 list. That by statute, we rank and grade buildings every year, but we don't have you on. Once you're on, you're on, and nobody's going to pass you until we present a remedy for that. That's our current of operations. That's the way we're doing it. So it will not change the list at all in the short.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Got the green light on here. I'd just like to have the body take note of what we're doing and the progress that we're making. As was pointed out, the commission has spent $1.3 billion on capital construction for our schools, elementary, secondary, across the state. Not one dime from bonded indebtedness of the communities. Not one dime. I think the last high school to be built in Wyoming, using almost completely bonded indebtedness, was up in the northern part of the state. After that, we've come along this way, and it strikes me that here we have a Department of Education, we have a State Board of Education, we have all the various districts, and now we're creating yet another department to handle, independent of the State Board of Education, independent of the State Department of Education, and without participation of the local communities, a capital building construction department that means that it's going to exist for a long, long time. We talk about the lack of public participation in its support of elementary, secondary education. We're a part of that problem. We have taken away the participation of the need for their own public education, K through 12, their own structure of administration of curriculum, and we are deterring further, one more inroad, into taking away the local participation for excellence of their own children in their own schools. I'm not really sure that doing what we're doing is in behalf of the future of educational quality opportunity. So on that, I'm questioning whether going any further with this measure is the right thing for our education future.
Master Majority Whip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rising on in support of the bill. You know, there are some gentlemen across the street that wear black robes, and we were mandated to build these schools. That ship has sailed. I would love to have been at the table where we could have created a system where we could equalize the power and do bonding at the local level and give these people more input. And I hope as we move forward, we can allow our local districts to have more input in the way we build schools. The bottom line, though, is that it is our obligation to pay for it and our obligation to build them. And we've created a system that didn't work quite as well as we'd hoped. This bill reorganizes that system. It tries to get the man downstairs back in charge, which I think is the right direction for us to go. And I think where we're at right now is where I don't want to be, and I think this bill takes us more in the right direction. And so there's been a lot of work, a lot of thought put into this bill, and I would urge the body to support it.
Chairman Illoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill looked pretty good. I would urge the good member of the Appropriations and who's bringing this to make sure that commission and department are used. It seems to be interchangeable in the rear part of the bill. It talks about the commission and the department or the department. It's a little hard to figure out what we're really talking about because it does say the commission and then it says the department, and it just appears that maybe the commission and the department are interchangeable, and I would just urge you to make sure that before we pass this bill, if it makes it out of here, and before we pass it on third reading, that those words are the way you want them.
Representative Harshman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to maybe provide an answer or comment on a few of the questions. You know, I wouldn't disagree about the way schools have changed. They're not as much a local affair. You know, when we did reorganization and really school of the Campbell One, we gave the taxpayers of this state a $3 million property tax decrease and took over really funding of schools. Now, don't get me wrong, most of the money that funds schools is still our local taxes, but it comes to the state and is redistributed. And we've been court mandated to do that because children's education is now the state's wealth, not on your local district's wealth. So as the good chairman said on that issue, it sailed. As far as with these buildings as well, you know those were the most watched elections when a school district would pass a bond issue. And a lot of thought, a lot of work, and that's not the case anymore. You're correct. But we've tried, I think their first attempt at this was to equalize bonds, but that was ruled unconstitutional. So we were with the system that we have. And you're good to point out that we haven't raised anybody's taxes to do this. Frankly, we've been lucky. We've had a tremendous bonus of particularly federal mineral royalties that have built most of our schools and some coal lease bid bonus money in the early part of this past decade. So that part of that. So that's my response, I guess. That ship has sailed. We've sawed that sawdust. I don't think we're going back on that. I think the comment from the good chairman of corporations about I think if you read this into the statute starting on page 32 and it talks about, or 33, about the members and the powers and duties, and really we're talking about budgeting, developing knowledge, those kind of things. But if you go through the bill, it clearly delineates what is commission policy and what is department duty. And frankly, that's why it's so thick, and that's why I've given you this matrix that'll really walk you through that. Each issue, you know, the first one is district facility plans. The next is school building assessment, surplus buildings. And because right now it's just kind of a mix hanging out there. And we clearly identify that. And then, again, with good legislative oversight, because it is such a large expense, and then good management by the executive. So urge your support for the bill, and I'd stand for any more questions.
Any more discussion on the bill? Chairman Harvey.
You can tell I'm having a hard time deciding if I want to say something about this or not, but I guess...
Tell that, Chairman Harvey.
It just seems to be that we are working harder at getting control of how money is spent, and this is just such a good way to do it. I sit on the Select Committee for School Facilities and watching the transition and watching the fluctuation and watching the numbers come and go, it just seems like if for no reason alone other than the director will then be serving at the will of the governor, just seems to me like this is a good way to go. The commission still has a voice in,
in standards and buildings, et cetera, but it just seems to put one more step of accountability into it. So I would urge your I vote on this bill.
Representative Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've been told twice now that the ship has sailed. I think it may be at half mast, and we might be adrift. When we talk about the schools and responding to the Supreme Court, I know I'm not supposed to mention that, but that opinion, we have built a number of new schools, and the kids now that attend those schools are in much safer habitat. I think that's agreed. But where they had 9 kids per class before, they've got 9 kids per class today. So when we talk about our terrible expenses that we have incurred in the last few years for education, and we are told that we're not getting our money's worth by some of the very people that are supporting this, it just strikes me as irony that they take that $1.3 billion and charge it against public education and expected something more from it than what they got. Don't blame it on the teachers. Don't blame it on the administration. Don't blame it on the local boards. Better take a look at ourselves at how we're directing public education. Its support is really needed from us as well as from the communities. And I don't know that this is an advancement of that support. Thank you.
Any more discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Chairman Berger's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report it, to do so with the recommendation that Senate File 110 do pass, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Senate File 110 has passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
Clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. Speaker, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, beg leave to report as follows. Senate File 2, recommended do pass. Senate File 11, recommended do pass. Senate File 15, recommended do pass. Senate File 17, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 22, recommended do pass. Senate File 23, amended, recommended do pass. Senate File 28, recommended do pass. Senate File 32, recommended do pass. Senate File 31, recommended do pass. Senate File 41, recommended do pass. Senate File 110, recommended do pass. Signed, Representative Brown, Chairman.
Chairman Brown.
Mr. Speaker, I move the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And those opposed, no. Committee of the Whole report is adopted. Congratulations. We're at that order of business, messages from the Senate.
Message number 216. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 121, Performance-Based Evaluation and Design. Ayes 28, noes 2. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 217. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 139, Health Care Pilot Project Amendments. Ayes 29, noes 1. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 218. Mr. Speaker, the bills as below passed failed to pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 140, Kindergarten Attendance. Ayes 15, noes 15. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Mr. Speaker, message number 219. The bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 143, Federal Natural Resource Policy. Ayes 27, noes 3. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 220. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below failed to pass the Senate third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 52, Teacher Tenure. Ayes 12, noes 18. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message 221. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below pass the Senate on third reading in an amended form by the vote indicated. Senate File 107, Energy Impacted County Roads Program. Ayes 26, noes 4. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk. Message number 222. Mr. Speaker, the bills listed below failed to pass the Senate on third reading by the vote indicated. Senate File 125, Healthcare Facilities Crisis Management. Ayes 15, noes 15. Signed, Diana Williamson, Senate Chief Clerk.
Reports from standing committees.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 4, Education, to whom is referred Senate File 101, engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass with amendments. Ayes, Brechtel, Burkhart, Connolly, Freeman, Croker, Crone, Laux, Madden, Teeters. Signed, Representative Teeters, Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom is referred Senate File 3, engrossed, recommends that this bill do pass with amendments. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illaway, Yagi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Shepperson, Stubson. Signed, Representative Stubson, Vice Chair. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom is referred Senate File 20, engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation it do pass with the following amendments. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Yagi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Shepperson, Stubson. Excused, Illaway. Signed, Representative Stubson, Vice Chairman. Mr. Speaker, your committee number 7, Corporations, Elections, and Political Subdivisions, to whom is referred Senate File 77, engrossed, respectfully report same back to the House with the recommendation that it do pass. Ayes, Blickery, Byrd, Illaway, Yagi, Croker, Patton, Roscoe, Shepperson, Stubson. Signed, Representative Stubson, Vice Chairman.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Having voted on the prevailing side of House Bill 191, I am giving notice of my intent to ask for reconsideration of the third reading vote tomorrow at the end of third reading.
Committee announcements. Chairman McComey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 6, Travel, will meet tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. in room 302, where we will consider the following bills. Senate File 63, engrossed, game and fish donation of hunting licenses, and Senate File 47, concealed weapons.
Chairman Childers.
Mr. Speaker, your committee number 3 will meet Wednesday morning, February the 9th at 9 a.m. in room H11 to consider one bill, Senate File 99, sales tax on certain food items.
Chairman Brown.
Mr. Speaker, your Judiciary Committee number 1 will meet tomorrow morning, Wednesday, February 9th at 6:59 a.m. to consider the following bills. Senate File 89, Adult Protective Services. Senate File 94, Liability for Emergency Equipment Donations. Senate File 128, Abandoned Vehicle Storage Expenses. And Senate File 137, Ignition Interlock Devices.
Madam Chair Korberg.
Mr. Speaker,
Your committee number 8, Transportation and Military Affairs, will meet today, 10 minutes after adjournment, room H-17. We will hear Senate File 18, Federal Motor Carrier Safety Act Compliance, Senate File 26, Engrossed, County Roads, Speed Limits, and Local Authority to Alter, Senate File 42, Engrossed, Choice License Plates for Disabled Veterans, and Senate File 43, Engrossed, Title 19, Veterans Commission Duties.
Chairman Teeters.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 4, Education, will meet Wednesday, February 9th, immediately upon adjournment in H-10 for consideration of the following bills. Senate File 16, Engrossed, School Facility Adequacy Assessments. Senate File 36, Engrossed, Seclusion and Restraint in Schools.
Chairman Lockhart.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet tomorrow morning at 8:00 in room H-18 to consider the following bills. Senate File 120, Workforce Services and Employment Reorganization, and Senate File 119, Real Estate Brokers and Salesmen Revisions 2.
Madam Chair Harvey.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, will meet Wednesday, February 9th. 15 minutes upon adjournment in room H-17, where we will hear Senate File 59, Engrossed, Vice Drugs, Senate File 90, Engrossed, Wyoming Nurse Practice Act Amendment, Senate File 25, Engrossed, Long-Term Care, Long-Term Services and Support.
Okay. Tonight, the Cowgirls take on the New Mexico Lobos, and so we have the ukulele's back. I know, some days it's just too much. So whenever you're ready. Oh, wait. Stand by. Representative Yagi.
Just before we get real excited singing for the Cowgirls, one of our favorite guys, Pete Simpson, bringing his Wyoming Futures class over tomorrow. We'll be introducing them to the floor, but he has 5 groups, and they'll be here at 9 o'clock, and if anybody's free and could meet with these, there'll be about 4 kids in each group. They'll be out here and upstairs. They would really appreciate you guys talking to them. It's on severance tax, child obesity, contractor preference points, domestic violence, rural health care. So if you could, if anybody has some free time, look them up and just make him feel welcome, because he's really trying to get them a little bit introduced to our feelings as legislators and bringing them over from UW. So he'd appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Cowgirls, here we go. She always sings, rats in the cattle as she sings, back and forth in a saddle on a horse, let her sink a pit and get it in. I'll hear the meter through the roar, hear the meter how she runs. When they hear the sailor coming, tell the western folks all know she's a cowgirl. Ragtime cowgirl, Joe. She always sings, packing music to the cattle as it swings, back and forth in a saddle on a horse. Let us think of it again, then you ought to hear the meter of the roar of the beater, how they run. When they hear her coming, let the western folks all know she's a ragtime cowgirl. Ragtime cowgirl, Joe.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. General file bills for Wednesday, February 19th, 2011, hump day. First 10 bills, you'll notice, are all committee bills. Senate files 74, 75, 5, 6, 4, 3, 20, 27, and then into the joint resolutions, and then after that, individual bills. With that, Mr. Speaker, I move that the House adjourn until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, Wednesday, February 9th, 2011.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The House is adjourned until Wednesday, February 9th, 2011, 10 a.m.